And I would also like to move the A1 amendment, which I've worked on with the Department of Human Services, and that puts the bill in shape, you know, in shape I would like to have it in for presenting to the committee. I'm sorry.
That's all right, Representative Thompson. This is your first bill, and I remember stumbling a little bit on my first bill too. That's normal. Representative Thompson moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that he would like for the first committee stop. This will be a voice vote. If everyone could unmute, please. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Thompson, please go ahead and present your bill as amended.
You know, thank you again, Chair. House File 722 requires, I'm sorry, I guess I'll get to that part, but it requires a 5% increase to a special payment rate that the Commissioner of Human Services is already authorized to offer under current law. That rate uses the state's chemical dependency fund to reimburse substance use disorder providers whose programs are culturally specific or serve patients with disabilities. Increasing this rate would improve the financial incentives for the providers to offer these services to populations that can benefit, from, you know, a more customized treatment. The A1 amendment also adds technical assistance from DHS that modernized the language for this special rate and applies the national standard for which what qualifies as culturally specific and responsive treatment to ensure that we're investing in effective services, Chair Fisher and members. The department will provide a more detailed walkthrough of the amendment as part of their testimony also, so I want to make sure that you're updated on, I mean, we're prepared for that. So with that, I'd like to go to the testifier so you can hear from, you know, the providers that are currently use this special rate to provide, you know, specialized services and treatments.
Certainly. Thank you, Representative Thompson. We will go to our first testifier then. Our first testifier, I believe, is Ms. Gilbert. If you could please introduce yourself and who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Thompson. My name is Molly Gilbert. I'm the Director of Business Development at Vinland National Center.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you for bringing up this bill and for having us here. Mr. Chair, committee members, Vinland National Center is a nonprofit residential and outpatient substance use disorder treatment provider located in Loretto, Minnesota. The outpatient is in Northeast Minneapolis. And I'm here today with Vinland's executive director, Mary Rail. Since 1990, Vinland has provided drug and alcohol addiction treatment for people with cognitive disabilities and TBIs, traumatic brain injuries. Vinland was the first in the country to design a treatment program to meet these unique needs of the individuals that are living with brain injuries. And we've developed a strong national reputation for providing top quality integrative services to individuals with TBIs, mental illness, learning disabilities, and or other cognitive disabilities. So we're exclusively serving this population. Our comprehensive approach to substance use disorder treatment integrates conventional treatment services along with a wide variety of complementary care services, which we're very well known for, our therapeutic exercise center. We focus on nutrition, mental health education, and other recreational activities. We're on about 170 acres of restored prairie, forest, and lakefront. So the nature is a big part of what we expose our clients to. As a result, Vinland's program often works for individuals who may have been unsuccessful in other treatment settings. So on average, we don't see a client here at Vinland until they've had 7 unsuccessful treatments. I just kind of want everybody to hear that, you know, because TBI is not recognized. It's not something that other treatment centers are looking for to identify. And oftentimes our clients don't self-identify with it. So it takes people a while to find us and get to us. And we're one of very few in the country, like I said. So because of its specialized treatment program, we're currently part of a subset of SUD providers who are considered culturally specific or who serve special populations and receive a small rate enhancement. Just so you know, since 2013, we received a 2.8% total increase. So our wages have remained very low. Other eligible providers include organizations serving immigrant and refugee communities, communities of color, indigenous communities, the LGBTQ plus community, and others who benefit from a specialized or tailored treatment program. While all SUD treatment providers have been struggling to serve those with medical assistance, this subset of providers has been particularly hard hit by the decreased censuses and increased costs associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. As such, individuals who may need the services of these specialized providers are at risk of losing access to the services that individuals with private pay options may have access to quite easily. In an attempt to try and preserve this critical treatment infrastructure and ensure disparities in access to care don't increase, HF-722 would provide a 5% increase to the culturally specific and special population rate enhancement. We believe these additional dollars could go a long way to preserving this highly specialized treatment infrastructure in Minnesota during a time of unprecedented challenges. Thank you so much for your time today. And both Mary Rail and I are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. We'll go on to our next testifier, and then we'll open it up for questions. Our next testifier is Ms. Grammi from the Department of Human Services. If you'd like to unmute yourself and start your identify yourself and start your testimony, please. Not hearing you. Still not be able to hear you as you're coming through there. It doesn't look like you're muted. Is the microphone plugged in?
Mr. Chair, if I could recommend, maybe we can see if there are questions from Ms. Gilbert while we get this worked out.
Okay, thank you. Great recommendation. While we're working on technical issues there, are there any questions for Ms. Gilbert or for the author at this point in time? Representative Baker, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's great to see my friends from Vineland Center. Good morning, Mary and Molly. It's nice to see you guys. It is a fabulous campus out in Loretto, and if members get a chance when it's a little bit easier to travel about, it is definitely worth a tour. They do amazing things out there, and I'm really proud to be supporting their work and for many, many years. Maybe my question was to Molly. I worked a couple of years ago on getting a rate increase back in maybe 2017, and it was the first one we got through in a long time. And so, Representative Thompson, I'm glad you're bringing this forward. I've got a lot of questions about the cultural specific about this, but maybe to Mary and Molly specifically, do you treat people with TBI differently if they have, again, whether they're people of color or not? Do you find that that's what we're getting down to here with treatment for people with TBI, if they're indigenous or if they're African-American or white, do you treat them differently? Is that what you're getting down to, is that we need different? I want to basically understand this better.
Ms. Gilbert?
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, thank you again for your support. TBI is the special population. There's no one else in the state that has the clinicians that have the training to deal with this. They go through something called a certified brain injury specialist training, which is very hard. I have a master's degree. I tried it. I took like 2 points. It's not easy. But they're clinicians. They're prepped for this. And so other treatment centers don't offer that. So it doesn't matter, you know, their origin or their nationality or whatever it may be. We serve all of the above, but it is specifically those with the disabilities that are having a hard time getting treatment anywhere else and therefore failing, because what happens is they'll be called non-compliant. Say they go to Hazelden Mainstream, which I love, you know, but they go to a mainstream treatment center where they're expected to keep up at a certain rate, and they figure out, the clinicians figure out within 30 days, these people aren't keeping up, and they don't understand that there's a brain injury, so they're called non-compliant, they're kicked out of treatment, and on you go. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Baker?
Mr. Chair, thanks. Just a quick follow-up. So I want to, and so I think the key is to understand culturally specific when you were doing that. Are you suggesting that the TBI is what's making it culturally specific? I see the head nodding. Okay, that's what I needed to hear. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay, super. And I see Representative Baker is out there, but we're going to wait a second because I understand that Ms. Graume is able to communicate with us now, so we'll go to her part, and then we'll come back to the questions, and we'll start with Mr. Back.
Chair, I don't have a question. I'm just letting you know that I'm here finally. I had an internet problem.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. I appreciate you checking in with us. Ms. Graume, if you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself and start your presentation, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So for the record, my name is Christy Graume. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to be a part of this important discussion and to walk through the amendment and the TA that we provided to the bill author. So I'll start out by saying that the technical assistance we provided was drafted to align with the intent of the underlying bill by really clarifying what it means to be a culturally specific or a culturally responsive provider, while recognizing that I think the end goal for all of us is to make sure that people have access to treatment services that support them in their recovery journey. So, if helpful, I think I'll maybe walk through the amendment for members to kind of clarify what we've done, because it's a little bit longer than the underlying bill. So section one of the amendment modifies the definition of culturally specific in chapter 254B. So we add the term culturally responsive to the definition to clarify that it's not only about serving a specific population or a community, but also about being responsive to the unique cultural preferences within those communities and within any individual that might be accessing treatment services. The new language on page 1, lines 8, 9, and 20 through page 2, line 2, is all language that previously existed in law in the rate section of chapter 254B. So the definition of culturally specific was sort of bifurcated, and it lived in two sections of law. It lived in the definition section, so to speak, and then the rate section. So we just pulled up that language from the rate section to really clarify and make it easier for all of us to understand the definition and the standard. The other substantive change in section one is on page one, line 14, where we add culturally and linguistically appropriate services standards to the definition of culturally specific. So these are also known as CLASS standards. They're standards that were developed by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in 2000 to inform practices related to culturally and linguistically appropriate health services, really in an effort to advance equity, improve quality, and help eliminate disparities. So moving to the changes in section two of the amendment, there's a new subdivision that's added related to what it means to be a provider that's responsive to disability-related needs and preferences. So this was also part of the bifurcated definition that I mentioned earlier in the rate section. It was previously referred to as special populations, which Ms. Gilbert was speaking to earlier. So here again, we're just consolidating the definition in the appropriate section of law, so it's easier for everyone to understand what that definition and standard is. We also removed the term special and replaced it with disability just to sort of clarify and modernize the language, and then also expand upon what that definition means. So pointing out that it could be for providers who serve people with a variety of physical, developmental, and cognitive disabilities. Section 3 modifies the rate section that I mentioned earlier in 254B. So this is, changes in this section are mostly just cleanup. So page 3, lines 30 to 31 are deleted on account of the changes made in section 2 with the new addition and subdivision of subdivision 4 of disability-specific providers. The deleted language on page 4, lines 1 through 9 is restated in the definition section in section 1 above that I described a bit ago. And then the added language on page 4, line 32, addresses the disaggregated definition of culturally specific with special populations, just to ensure that both of those provider types would be eligible for this enhanced rate. And then moving to the session law parts of the amendment, so section 5 requires the commissioner to actually implement class standards and provide some guidelines around how we would go about doing that. And then section 6 establishes funding for implementation grants to support providers in transitioning to those class standards. So I hope that summary is helpful. I'm happy to answer questions from members at this time. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Grami, for that presentation and explanation of the amendment. I see that Representative Franke has a question. Representative Franke, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I have some questions. So I'll start with the beginning of the bill in section 1. I'm a little bit concerned about, first off, going from a, 13 lines of a bill to 6 pages overnight. So I've been pouring through this, and I guess I'd like to ask Representative Thompson first, the bill author, what's his intent for the increase? Was the amendment a result of the intent of the underlying bill, and what his thinking on that was?
Representative Thompson.
Representative Franken, can you ask that question again? I didn't hear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thompson, I was just wondering if the amendment was brought after the bill introduction, and the amendment, it went from, basically 5 lines of a bill to 6 pages. Was the amendment brought to you by the agency saying that if we actually need to do this, your initial intent in the bill, we need to completely revamp this overnight and come up with 6 new pages of law?
Representative Thompson.
Hey, Chair Fisher, if you may, I thank you for the question. But I just wanted to share something real quick, if you will, Chair. A friend of mine here, Corey, right now, he comes by my house every other day, and he shares with me that he's addicted to opioids, Percocets, by the way. He's sick. He says, I'm sick, and I want to get help. And I find it virtually impossible to find Corey a facility to get him in so he can get the help. 2 years ago, Rajan, my good friend Rajan, I called him and I told him I was on my way to his house. So if anybody called, that let him know I'd be on my way. And when I got there, he hung himself in his garage. Him too, also addicted to opiates. So it was important to me. This is something that I'm very passionate about, that I get this right. And so I dug in and I did a lot of work with DHS and a lot of others. So there was nobody that said, this is what we want. This is what we need in my community, Representative Franke. And so I respect your question, but I know that when we talk about culturally specific services needed in our community, like my friends are dying. It's kind of hard to be optimistic in my case when I'm losing my friends about the things that we need. I know that we need this in our community. And so that's why I try to take my time and get it done right. So I'm sorry if it's just 6 or 7 pages of paperwork, but it really needs to be done right. And like, if it took 10 pages to get done, I would submit 10 pages to you.
Thank you. Representative Franke, any other further questions?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I would just like to reiterate to Representative Thompson that I agree. I think this is a pretty good bill. It just seems kind of rushed through a little bit. I have some questions about stuff, and we need this all over the state. I agree. And my question wasn't the need for it. It was just like, we draft this bill and then overnight we get this other stuff. So I was just wondering, like, did someone come to you and say, like, and I understand because I've been in that position, like, oh, well, if you want to do that, what we really need to do is get all this other stuff done. You know what I mean? Because just the change was kind of expansive. So I think you kind of answered my question. I'll just move on to my next questions, which are more technical in nature, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Frankie. And I also see Representative Eckerfin has her hand up out there too. So she'll be next after you're done there.
This is probably for Ms. Grammi, Mr. Chair. I'll start with my first question is on in the amendment, line 1.6, we've deleted recovery focused. And that's kind of troublesome for me because that's what we're working on here. And replaced it with culturally responsive. So I'm wondering, why did we delete recovery focused?
Ms. Grammi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, thank you for the question. So we deleted recovery focused, thinking that all of our SUD treatment programs are recovery focused. So it was really just a clarification that it was sort of unneeded language in there. We didn't want to, it just felt appropriate to sort of clean it up there. But if it's something that members are wanting to reinsert, I think we're absolutely open to that conversation. And just to be, and the culturally responsive piece was really added kind of, as I mentioned earlier, just to make sure that we're being culturally responsive and culturally specific to make sure that that definition is comprehensive and covering all provider types of people that are being served.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I personally, I would feel more comfortable, you know, leaving recovery focused, comma, culturally responsive. But when it comes to, and then that comes to another point that I have, culturally responsive and culturally specific. Now I can find in law a definition for culturally specific program in 254B.01, subdivision 4A. Are we going to be culturally responsive is not defined in that section of law. And then, so are we going to be adding that to that at some point? And as I've spoken to you about, Chair, and on the next bill, there's some other sections here. And I'm just going to form these as a statement, not a question, I guess, about this part, because I think it would just be easier on all of us. I would like to see some changes in some of the verbiage to certain lines, like line 1.21, line 1.9, and maybe 3.29 of the amended bill to reflect the language from section 148E.010 as we discussed. So we're pulling in everybody. I don't want to leave, and I think it goes to the crux of the bill when we're talking about underrepresented communities, because I want to make sure that we are defining our underrepresented groups and not leaving people out. Our LGBTQ plus, yep. Definitely a physical ability. I really want to make sure we're including all those underserved communities, because as defined in section 148E.010 for everybody's understanding, subdivision 20, underrepresented community, a community that means a group that is not represented in the majority with the respect to race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, or physical ability. So I would like to make sure that we're covering all the groups when we're talking about this rate increase, because as we all know, when it comes to addiction and mental health, a lot of these groups are having hard times. We need to make sure we're taking care of everybody.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Frankie, for that. And that, if I remember right, is because we had the other amendments out on the other bill we're going to hear early, you were able to get that amendment out there. And I would think that would be something definitely is that Representative Thompson would and the department would work to make sure that we have those things, making sure that we're not leaving groups like the LGBTQ community out of there. So the great observation. Appreciate you raising that up for us to make sure that we're not losing that focus.
And then I just have one more quick question at this time, Mr. Chair, for Ms. Grom, if that's okay.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Franke, and then we'll move after that. Then we'll move on to Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Grom, and you don't have to tell me this right now. You could just get me an email if you like. But I'm wondering, what are the current rates and proposed rates going forward with the additional enhancements on the current rates and the proposed rates? And then how does that fall and ongoing? What are we going to be looking at in the tails as far as moving forward?
Ms. Grammy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franke, thank you for the question. So I believe I perhaps did follow up with an email on this, but we are happy to sit down and talk with you some more about this and do a full fiscal workup so that you understand what all of the fiscal impacts are. But the enhanced rate for this particular rate is identified in the CCDTF service rate grid that is on the department's website, and I can share that rate grid with members so you can get a sense of what that rate looks like right now for the various services, depending on if a person is in residential or non-residential treatment and depending on what service type is being provided. So happy to follow up with more information on that.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Grom.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Franke. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I get to what I actually raised my hand about, I did want to just point out, I know it's a little difficult virtually to have multiple windows open, but you know, the underlying bill is about culturally, the original language is about culturally specific chemical dependency services. And, you know, when I look at the amendment, what I'm seeing is sort of exactly what Representative Franke was speaking to in providing those definitions so that it is more clear what the underlying language was referring to. So I think, you know, although is a bit lengthier, I think it's making the bill better, which is the whole point of bringing an author's amendment forward after hearing from the department and other folks. But really, I just wanted to speak to and thank Representative Thompson for bringing this forward. Just as a personal example from my own family, you know, for specifically for a lot of Indigenous folks, but I'm sure the same is true for others who are struggling with addiction, you know, the dominant treatment strategy is sort of the, you know, the model, the AA model. And there's a lot of reference to God and a lot of that kind of language. And that language doesn't resonate with folks who maybe grew up with a more traditional understanding or, you know, came from a different background. And so that's why this is really important. I actually have a family member who has benefited from the services at Vinland because they were able to get that more nuanced, culturally specific treatment that was the one that stuck. And so I think this is incredibly important if folks, and I know a lot of folks, and a lot of us on this committee, that's one of the reasons we're here, but have either struggled or have family members and friends who have struggled. And it doesn't always stick the first time. And sometimes it takes lots of tries. And so it's really good to have these alternative programs that are more culturally specific, because hopefully those are the programs that stick. And those are the ones that really help people move forward and get through this stuff. So I really thank the testifiers and everyone who's working on this. This is a really important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckerfin. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, and again, if you've got other testifiers, I can wait till the end. I just wanted to make sure I had a few other comments, but if you've got other testifiers, I can wait.
We've had all our testifiers. Okay. Go ahead. So this is a perfect time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I didn't want to jump in. And again, I think what what Representative Becker Finn just kind of mentioned was important. And Representative Thompson, I also want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is important. And I think what I hear you saying is that we need to modernize our language. And I think that's what I heard Representative Becker Finn kind of suggesting too, because I am admittedly unfamiliar with how the deeper dive on culturally specific means. And I'll just say that because I want to understand it better. And because of my work in the addiction world and with our chemical dependency folks that are working their tails off to help people, when we start changing this direction or the definitions, I want to make sure we keep up. So let's make sure that we kind of understand the process. We're talking about a 5% increase for really everybody that is needing help in these specific issues and disabilities, and I understand that and completely get that. But I think part of what I heard my friend Representative Frankie asking was just it was confusing because it seemed at first that we were putting folks in more silos than we don't need. And I want to make sure to Ms. Gami from DHS that I have that right. We want to get the language right. I support an increase. And also to Representative Thompson, what I learned the hard way here in this session, or not this session, but from my time here in the House, is we can't write bills just because we all have emotions and families tied to this, but it helps drive our focus. And I'm just committing my support to you, Representative Thompson. If you have questions and want to know how the addiction services are working and how do we get rate increases, I'm more than happy to work with you. I've hit my head many times on the wall. I've learned some hard knocks. And when you have a group of people like yourself and Representative Frankie and others that have had a history in this thing, we have a bond, and we have to make sure we help our friends and family that have had to struggle through this. And you know, DHS as a whole has a lot of I think rebuilding our relationships with our treatment centers, with our payment structures, with our reimbursements, and we have to be a part of that solution. So I just wanted to more say high level. I'm learning some of the new words this year, Mr. Chair, and I have to, in confession here, I just want to make sure that I'm honest about my ignorance to this, but also we need to ask some of these kind of questions without feeling like we're trying to at all sidestep what's important. So it's important that we get this right. And again, I stand ready to help other authors in these kind of bills because this is really important. So that's maybe what I wanted to say. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Banker. Very, very well said. You've made some great points through there. This is great work where we all are together rowing in the same direction. So thank you for that. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to thank Representative Thompson for his work on this. This is, you know, as we can all agree, a needed area to delve into. And I just wanted to share a little story about, and it kind of piggybacks on what Representative Baker was saying about understanding and not knowing. And I think that all boils back to communication. And when we're working with policy like this on such delicate issues, sometimes it is just a simple story. It is just about reaching out and having that communication with each other. As you and I spoke yesterday, Mr. Chair, when I was asking questions about the class, the culturally linguistical appropriate services and what the standards were, and was there a national standard, which the question was now answered by Ms. Grom in her presentation. So we did get that answer. So that was one question I did not have to ask. But you had brought up, you know, about deaf people, and we're not only we're talking about all kinds of issues, and I'm very grateful that the physically challenged are included in this, because I brought up to a friend of mine that when we were talking about increased rates and how we were going to be helping people, and it's like, well, I don't understand that. And I said, well, let me tell you a little story about years ago when I was battling my demons. I said I was at a place and we had a deaf person in our facility with us, and they would have to bring in an interpreter to sit in group, and then also we would learn sign language a couple hours a week so that we could communicate with somebody within our group setting. I said, so that's an added cost, and that's why we need to make sure that the reimbursements rates are covering those things to help those people, to help the people with different challenges. So once again, it just goes to communicating, making sure we're getting it right, making sure, you know, that the words do matter, that we are covering everybody. So I want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Thompson and everybody for getting this right, and look forward to continuing. And yes, I would also like to let Representative Thompson know, if you ever have any questions, feel free to reach out to me also. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you, Representative Franke. There being no further discussion, Representative Thompson, do you have any final comments?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I do, just listening to all the comments, I do recognize that we're all trying to get to the same place. We're just in different cars. And I think we'll get there. We only get there together, though. So I thank you, Representative Franke, for your comments. Thank you, you know, especially when you point out, because we don't want to leave anybody out. Like, everybody needs this. And so I want to say thank you for your comments. And I will be reaching out. But no further comments, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Thompson. There being no further discussion, Representative Thompson renews his motion that House File 722, as amended, be recommended for referral to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Franke.
Franke, aye.
Franke, aye. Backer. Backer. Okay. Baker.
Baker, aye.
Baker, aye. Becker Finn.
Aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Katiza Watoon, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Thompson.
Thompson, aye.
Thompson, aye. Backer. You're still muted, Representative Backer. All right. Well, 11 ayes and 0 nays. The motion prevails.
Okay, thank you. There being 11 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails. House File 722, as amended, is recommended for referral to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. Congratulations, Representative Thompson. You've passed your first bill in a committee hearing. Next bill is going to be House File 970. The chair moves that House File 970 be recommended for referral to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. We do have an author's amendment, and this is the bill's first hearing, so the chair will move the A1 author's amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like for consideration by the committee. Representative Bang, welcome to the committee. Is there anything you would like us to know about the amendment before we adopt it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment, while making this bill, we forgot to add the Board of Psychology, so this amendment just adds that to the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bang. This being an amendment, author's amendment, this will be a voice vote. If you could unmute yourselves, would all in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Bang, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I believe we also have another amendment too. Should we do that one first before I proceed with the bill?
Why don't you go ahead and present your bill, and then we can go to the A2 amendment that is proposed out there.
Sounds good. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to present House File 970. This bill addresses a long-running problem, a shortage of mental health providers. For a long time, poor access to mental health care included rural communities where individuals are less likely to have a mental health treatment facility than metro counties. Communities of color are less likely to get treatment, the treatment they need, and low-income communities are less likely to have mental health treatment resources than high-income communities. So this bill brings comprehensive support and addresses a number of things in which my testifier will go through the bill to elaborate on each section. I think what's important to highlight is the amount of work that has been put into this bill to address this workforce shortage. This has been a result of coalitions and advocates working across the state to create these recommendations that now shape this bill. In 2013, the legislature passed a bill requiring the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, MNSCU, to convene a task force to develop a comprehensive plan to increase the number of qualified people working at all levels of our mental health system, ensure appropriate coursework and training, and to create a more culturally diverse mental health workforce. Meetings were held across the state, surveys were conducted, and a large summit was held. The report is entitled Gearing Up for Action, was submitted to the legislature in January 2015. Some but not all of the recommendations have been implemented, and several key issues remain. These include, one, ensuring access to and affordability of supervisory hours, two, requiring all third-party payers, commercial insurers, to reimburse in the same way that medical assistance does for supervision internships, so that services provided by mental health trainees under the supervision of a mental health professional are reimbursable by third-party payers, commercial insurance plans. Three, create training programs and stipend scholarships and pathways to licensure targeted at students from diverse communities. And four, improve and expand cultural competency awareness training. The Wilder Foundation, the Mental Health Improvement Workgroup, co-led by NAMI Minnesota and the Department of Human Services, also played a role in helping shape this bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to have my testifiers proceed on the importance of this bill.
Okay, and I also know that we referred to the A2 amendment. What I'm looking at here is we did say that we'd take up the A2 as soon as you're done with your explanation there. So the A2 amendment is presented by Representative Franke. Do you wish to move that amendment and give us a brief explanation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Okay, Representative Franke moves the A2 amendment. Representative Franke, if you'd like to give a quick explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fang, and thank you for the discussion yesterday about this. The A2, just page 13, line 12, after the comma insert, as defined in section 148E.010, subdivision 20. In all of these other boards and task force, we do have the new language being added with the definition underrepresented community as defined in section 148E.010 subdivision 20. Let's just say, for instance, on line 7.2, it is there. But when we got down to the other task force, that language was not defined in underrepresented community. So I just wanted to make sure once again that we're covering everybody, all the groups that are mentioned, and keeping the bill consistent moving forward. And that's my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Franke. Representative Vang, your comments on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to thank Representative Franke for your eagle eyes and making sure that we remain consistent throughout the bills. This is a friendly amendment, and I support it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bay. This will be a voice vote if everybody could unmute themselves. This is the motion to approve the A2 amendment as presented by Representative Franke. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. The A2 amendment is adopted. Thank you for that. And we'd like to go then to the testifiers for the underlying bill. And the first person we have is Ms. Sue Abderholden. If you'd like to introduce yourself and who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I have four short slides, if Mr. McCall could put them up, just to provide some data for folks. On the first slide, and you can see these are from the Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Rural Health, and primary care. So you can see the blue is the supply that we currently have versus the green bar, which is the demand. And so you can see that our supply is not close to meeting the demand for mental health professionals in Minnesota. Next slide. this slide shows that we have people who graduate with degrees, but then they don't become licensed. And so that is very concerning, and we know part of it is due to difficulty getting supervision and some of the licensing tests as well. And so just wanted to show people, excuse me, that that gap. Next slide. And then this shows the loan forgiveness program, which really has helped increase and keep our mental health professionals in Minnesota. You can see in terms of psychologists, clinical social workers, you know, marriage and family therapists, licensed professional clinical counselors, and the psychiatric nurse specialists. So we have been able to serve 133 people, 92 in greater Minnesota, 41 in the urban underserved areas. Next slide. Or maybe. And then this just shows you the median wages. So we know kind of big term, we need to really think about some of the rates that we provide our mental health providers. But you can see in comparison to, you know, dental hygienists or respiratory therapists versus, you know, our clinical social workers. And I think that's the last slide. Thank you. So as Representative Banks said, we have actually had a workforce shortage forever. We've never had enough mental health professionals in the field. And we are particularly seeing a shortage of BIPOC mental health professionals right now. And so in order to really meet the needs, especially in light of the pandemic, we need to start doing something. And again, we've had that report since 2015, many good things in the report, and we need to finish. But I want to say that this bill is really based on the feedback of people with mental illnesses and their families, our community mental health agencies, our mental health professionals, and students as well, and including professionals from the BIPOC community. You're going to hear from professionals, but I just want to point out that the lack of a robust, culturally diverse, and informed workforce leads to poor outcomes. Studies show that people from BIPOC and LGBTQ communities are less likely to access quality care, are more likely to use the emergency room, and are more likely to end up in the juvenile or criminal justice systems where they access care for the first time. Lack of a culturally informed workforce also means, for example, that Black men are 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than PTSD in comparison with white men with the same symptoms. People from BIPOC communities are less likely to be offered therapy. People who are Black are more likely to receive care in an inpatient setting. Asian adults have the lowest percentage in outpatient service use, and the suicide rates, particularly in the Native American and Latinx, among Latinx youth, is very high and disproportionate. And while the barriers in accessing care include negative attitudes associated with mental illness, distrust of the mental health care system, lack of knowledge about treating mental illnesses, and the lack of diverse providers, including speaking diverse languages, and providers who are culturally responsive. I think we can really address these barriers through this bill. And I'd like to just walk you through each of the sections. Section one is actually a bill that we've had for a little while, and this just makes sure that all of our private health insurance will pay for the clinical care provided by a clinical trainee. Medical assistance in Minnesota Care already does this, and so do some, but not all, private insurers. Section two adds licensed alcohol and drug counselors to the list of professionals who can participate in the loan forgiveness program. So this just kind of expands our mental health workforce to include them. And that's true under section three and four too. Section five would require the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy to have a more diverse board. So they'd have to have at least 2 members from outside the 11 county metro area and 3 members from a community of color or an underrepresented community. And again, we just want the boards to reflect the population of the state. Section six gets into the cultural training. So at least 6 of their 40 hours of continuing education have to be focused on culture. Understanding culture, its functions and strengths, the differences among and between cultures, the nature of social diversity and oppression, and the understanding of cultural humility. Now, I know you're going to ask, what is cultural humility? So according to the National Institute of Health, they define cultural humility as a lifelong process of self-reflection and self-critique, whereby the individual not only learns about another's culture, but one starts with an examination of his or her own beliefs and cultural identities. So it is a term of art that's being used, frankly, across the country. Section 7 requires the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy to have at least 5 members from outside the metro area and 5 members from the community of color. Section 8, again, goes to the licensed professional clinical counselors related to the cultural competency work. Section 9 is for the social workers to also have their at least 6 of their 40 hours be that way. And I do know that there were some questions about, why do we need to do this? I will say that 7 other states require cultural competency for their social workers with hours ranging from 1 to 6 hours. 7 other states require this for psychologists ranging from 2 to 6 hours. And so I just wanted to mention that other states are looking at doing this as well. Section 10 expands who can be a mental health practitioner. What we wanted to do was to include a student who is an undergraduate or a graduate in social work, psychology, or counseling program. You have to complete a practicum or an internship, and it's very difficult to do that work for free when you're also trying to go through school. And if they're a mental health practitioner, then the organization that is providing the supervision can actually include their work in terms of billing for services. And so that will address a huge barrier that we've seen. Section 11 expands the use of some of the mental health grants controlled by the Minnesota Department of Human Services to include paying for supervision for clinical trainees from BIPOC communities also paying for traditional healing practices in the Native American community. You did a small part of that under the opioid bill, but we also want to include this to mental health treatment as well. The issue that this addresses is that, again, we know that more people graduate from graduate school programs than are licensed, and a lot of this is because they can't pay for the supervision. Section 12 creates a culturally informed and responsive mental health task force, and their focus is really to help us continue to look at this issue and make sure that our workforce is actually meeting the mental health needs of Minnesotans. Section 13 creates a work group to discuss possible alternative pathways to licensure without sacrificing quality. People are not passing some of the national exams, often people whose first language is not English or clinicians from BIPOC communities. Many are missing it by just a few points, but it does not mean that they won't be good clinicians. There's also been questions as to the test being culturally informed. And so what we want is for the boards to come together, discuss the barriers to licensure, any data that we can find, and develop recommendations. I want to point out that's developing recommendations. Section 14 requires DHS and the Health Department to convene the licensing boards to discuss and develop recommendations on how to provide supervision across all licenses and make it easier for people, especially in greater Minnesota and BIPOC communities, to obtain supervision in order to become licensed. We've done a lot with telehealth this year and telesupervision, and so I think it's time to have a greater conversation there. Section 15 appropriates funds for the culturally responsive task force. Section 16 appropriates funds to pay for the continuing education so that mental health professionals, BIPOC mental health professionals, can actually become supervisors. So we increase the number of BIPOC mental health supervisors. And then Section 17 appropriates funds for the LADCs to access the Health Professional Loan Forgiveness Program and appropriates some additional funds to target mental health professionals from BIPOC communities. I will note that LADCs already have pretty extensive requirements for diversity training and that the Board of Social Work already requires representation from diverse communities and greater Minnesota. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present this really incredible bill, and I just want to thank all of the organizations that worked with us to make this happen.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for your testimony. We appreciate it. I know we've got hands going up here, but I'd like to get through the rest of our testifiers, and then I'll go to the representatives for questions. Our next testifier then is Ms. Yang. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony, please.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, everyone, Chair Fisher and members of the Behavioral Health Policy Division. My name is Pahua Yang, and I work at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. I want to thank you for having me here today. As both a social worker and a psychologist, I have lived through training and licensure for 2 of the fields represented in this bill. I have been a supervisor, a colleague, a mentor, a mentee, and many other roles for which I've witnessed incredible work be happening, as well as substantial barriers for people in the mental health field. So the bill you have in front of you is a comprehensive bill aimed at investing in building our workforce in the mental health and substance use disorders field. Both the workforce, well, really the workforce we needed yesterday, the workforce we need today, and for sure the workforce we'll need for tomorrow, especially if we want to build a better mental health system that works for everyone. The future of the mental health system rests on decisions that we need to make today or now in this time. There are many elements to this bill that I could speak about, but I want to specifically talk about the need to find alternative pathways for licensure for mental health professionals. For over 20 years across two states, and certainly in my 12 years at Wilder, I have watched colleagues, both at Wilder and in the community, repeatedly fail national board exams. My initial bias was they just weren't studying hard enough. But then I began to understand that I was seeing a different iteration of the same issues I've seen my entire life. That is actually, we have a whole field in psychology devoted to understanding how different populations score on different tests, especially standardized tests. So I'd just like to note that. And, you know, honestly, it reflects some of the work that I was doing when I was working in higher education with first-generation college students and students of color, where I would see the same patterns. Students who were coming in with 4.0s ranked number 1, 2, 3 out of 400, 500 students whose ACT scores were 16, 17, 18. And for those of you who haven't seen an ACT score for a while, those are pretty low scores. Ooh. I have staff at Wilder that have graduated from accredited programs, many of them nationally ranked. I have two women who have doctorates from APA accredited schools who can run circles around me as clinicians. And I say that without false modesty. That is just the truth. They are pioneers and leaders in our field. One of them is leading a team doing work with some of our most vulnerable children and families in a way that no one else in the country is doing, and we are getting results. The other one has an area of expertise that makes her the only one in the nation that has that expertise, and yet it took one of them over a decade and five times to pass the EPPP, which is a national exam for psychologists. The other person hasn't passed yet after three tries and has chosen a different path at my encouragement so that I could finally pay her the salary for the work she was already doing. And yet I count myself lucky among the lucky few who can say to my staff, you will have a job at Wilder whether you pass the test or not. Some of my colleagues can't do that. I have seen highly clinically skilled colleagues who have lost their jobs because of lack of licensure, and some have left the field completely, which breaks my heart. Think about the significance of this. In a time when we don't have enough workforce, we have highly competent people leaving the field simply because we, and I count myself in that, we have not been able to offer a different way to evaluate their competence for licensure. But there are also additional costs, even if people stay in the field. In our field, without a license, there is no career advancement. You make less than other people. You don't have the same title when you're doing the same work, and you can't practice independently. And too many times, highly skilled, culturally competent clinicians are getting supervised by people with less experience, but people who pass the test. I'm here today to ask you as leaders in our state for help. We have a moment where we can keep choosing the status quo. We can keep choosing to do what we're doing, knowing that we are not building the workforce we need for Minnesota, or we can choose to do something different. We can choose to build a system that works for all Minnesotans by investing in our workforce. We can choose to do the right thing during a time when doing the right thing can feel really hard. And for me, this bill represents the opportunity to do that. So thank you for hearing me today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Yang, for your testimony and for sharing what people are experiencing out there, for the work that you're doing. Next person we have to testify today is Dr. Garrett. Dr. Garrett, if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony.
Sure. First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair Fisher and members of the Behavioral Health Policy Division. I am a licensed psychologist who has practiced in Minnesota for 40 years. I'm also the president of the Minnesota Association of Black Psychologists. Most of the Black therapists achieved their degrees during the time of affirmative action during the late 1970s and 80s, when universities intentionally recruited Black students. Since then, the number of Black students in clinical programs have consistently declined. Approximately half of the Black students have now, Black therapists have now retired or returned home to care for aging parents. The result is a crisis in Black mental health care. Other communities of color and rural communities also have extreme shortages of mental health professionals. There are Africans, Hmong, Latinos, and Native Americans living in every county in Minnesota. However, there are 9 counties that have no mental health professionals and many areas that just have one provider. In addition, there is a shortage of Caucasian providers who are culturally competent in BIPOC and rural mental health care. Therapists without training in BIPOC, LGBTQ, and rural mental health are likely to misdiagnose clients, which often results in either inappropriate treatment, harm, or delayed care. The consequence is clients having failed care repeatedly and then needing expensive treatments such as inpatient hospitalization. With the opioid crisis, methamphetamine, and alcohol addictions, long-term stress from the COVID-19 pandemic and social justice issues from the George Floyd event, there's a perfect storm for mental health disaster in Minnesota right now. As you know, mental health providers are essential to a healthy society. They help maintain a productive workforce, improve academic achievement, supports healthy families and communities, offers disaster recovery supports, and reduces medical incarceration and social service costs as well. A significant barrier to becoming a mental health professional is the cost of education. Also, low reimbursement from insurance companies and Medicare, and low salaries that cannot compensate for high student loans. Many small communities in greater Minnesota cannot afford the salary of a mental health professional without loan forgiveness. BIPOC therapists also serve populations that require high unpaid services, such as citizenship medical waivers and advocacy dealing with systems issues, thus reducing their compensation for care. This bill provides a comprehensive array of strategies that address building a more informed and competent mental health workforce in our state. I strongly support the efforts outlined in this bill and urge your support to invest in strengthening our mental health system for all Minnesotans by investing in our workforce. Thank you for allowing me to speak today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dr. Garrett. Thank you for being here today and sharing what you've seen and sharing the history of some of where we've been and where we've gotten to now. Sure. Thank you for that. We will now go to questions and comments. The first person I have is Representative Jamie Becker-Pinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just really wanted to highlight how important this is. And I wanted to actually go back to something that Ms. Abderholden had on one of her slides about comparing this work to other sort of health related fields, and just wanted to really lift up the reality is that this kind of work is, practitioners are exposing themselves to trauma, secondary and vicarious trauma from the work that they do. They, depending upon you know, what kind of facility they're working in. They're also, you know, potentially putting themselves at different kinds of physical risk. And it's really hard work. And I want to thank all the testifiers for the work that they do and really emphasize how important that piece of it. Because even if we paid people the same as in these other fields, you know, are you going to choose the job where you have to be on call and take, you know, difficult calls at all hours of the day where, you know, you're going to be exposed to sort of the worst days of people's lives on a regular basis compared to, you know, not to diminish the importance of keeping people's teeth clean, but, you know, they're just, it's not an apples and oranges comparison. And it's, you know, we have to be able to support and pay these folks for the work that they do, because all the other things we've talked about in this committee, the staffing piece is really key. We can't do all the other good things that we're trying to do if we don't have the practitioners who are trained and licensed to do the work. And so I'm really glad that this is moving forward, and I hope that others are paying attention, because we can't, you know, there's going to be things that are in other committees that folks want to do. And if we don't have the practitioners to do the work, you know, who are licensed to do it, we're not going to be able to do all that good that we want to do that we've talked about in almost every other hearing. So thank you, Representative Vang. And I, again, just wanted to lift up the reality of what it's like for practitioners in this field. So thank you to the testifiers as well.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Fedd. Representative Todd Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And like Representative Becker-Fedd, I want to thank Representative Vang and the stakeholders for their work on this bill. It's incredibly important. Rural communities have, and I especially appreciate the focus on BIPOC communities and cultural humility. I love that phrase. I think it's very, very helpful. Rural communities have been diverse in Minnesota and are becoming increasingly diverse. And I have a question related to this increasing diversity. So in my district, the community of Montgomery has a significant Latinx population. In Northfield, we have a significant Latinx population, a growing East African population. Just south of my district in Northfield, or excuse me, in Faribault, there's a very large Latinx and a Somali population. And I know the need for mental health in those communities is great, and substance abuse treatment is great. And Ms. Abderholden, in your slides at the very beginning, you had a statewide kind of a slide showing the need for mental health professionals. And Dr. Garrett talked about this a little bit, but I'm wondering if you're able to quantify the need for culturally specific mental health and substance abuse treatments in these new American communities across the state, or in BIPOC communities across the state. Are you able to kind of dig into that question at all?
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you.
Ma'am. Apologize.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I'm looking for my notes because I did have that information somewhere on my desk. So in 2017, 29% of bachelor's, people earning their bachelor's, and 34% of people earning their master's from Minnesota's mental health post-secondary programs were people of color. Yet in 2019, only 12% of licensed mental health providers, including practitioners, professionals, and LADCs, were people of color. So a very small percentage, certainly not enough.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Dr. Garrett has anything to add on this question as well. He was speaking to some of that in his sure. remarks.
Dr. Sure. Garrett?
Yes. As of last year, we had 25 licensed African-American psychologists. Now, there are other African-American therapists who are like social workers, marriage and family therapists, and have substance abuse credentials as well. But there are 25 African-American psychologists. Of that 25, eight of them now are child adolescent therapists. And so it's a really kind of scary situation because there are thousands and thousands of children of color. And just looking at the African-American children, there clearly are not enough therapists for African-American children, but for adults as well. And of that 25, about half of them are of retirement age already. Already we're at that point. And there's no way that we can serve the African-American community ourselves, but also when you're a Black psychologist, you also serve the other communities of color, because when a person is in the system and if they request a culturally competent therapist, the largest number of therapists of color are African-American. And so more often they get referred to an African-American. So we are treating not just the Black community, but other communities of color. In my practice, it varies somewhere between 40 and 50% of my clients are actually Hmong, actually. But I serve all the communities, including the white communities as well. But the numbers are dropping for Black psychologists, and it's at a critical level at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Garrett. And I also see we have somebody from the department that can also speak to us on this issue. Terry Pristma, please. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Fisher. My name is Terry Pristma, and I just wanted to jump in to just sort of take a step back. I'm the lead healthcare workforce researcher at the Minnesota Department of Health. And so we do track demographics for mental health providers. And in the latest survey that we have, just across the board, mental health providers are anywhere between 88 and 90% white. And in the state of Minnesota, according to the demographer's office, Minnesotans are about 20% people of color. So it just gives you a broad breakdown on kind of the mismatch between the demographics of providers and the state as a whole.
Thank you, Ms. Fritzma. Appreciate the statistical information there. Representative Lippert, any further follow-up questions?
No, Mr. Chair, just a comment. As Dr. Garrett was speaking, I was thinking about both my experience as a pastor and time in my own time, you know, in therapy as well. And the question is, will this person understand me and understand my situation? And so I think the need for cultural humility and eliminating these obstacles is incredibly important. So I thank you for this work.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. You know, it's definitely needed. We need to fill these gaps and create these opportunities to help this. You know, I want to make a quick comment and then just have a little bit of advice for Representative Vang, hopefully on this bill. But, you know, I want to go back to what Ms. Yang was saying about the testing. You know, I'm one that believes that, you know, the quality of your experience doesn't always come from testing, especially when it wraps around this field. If experience didn't work, then any 12-step program or any way that a lot of these recovery programs are built would not work, because it causes you to go out and find somebody who's doing it and who's doing it right, and you try to work with them. And so sometimes the testing doesn't always get it right. And there's definitely a need and a passion that somebody has to have to be in this profession. So I applaud everybody that works within this industry. And I thank all of the testifiers and anybody who does this work. To the bill, I was noticing in Section 17, the appropriation for the loan forgiveness program, and this is just a comment for the representative, hopefully that can be taken forward. It says here that a third of the money is going specifically to Black, Indigenous, or people of color, and I just want to ask you to think about including the other groups of underrepresented communities in that loan program forgiveness so that we can make sure that all of these underrepresented communities, people with, you know, the sexual orientation, gender, the LGBTQ plus community, take a look at that, because I would really appreciate that. And that's all I have, Mr. Chair. This is a good bill, and I'll be supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frankie, for your comments. Next, Representative Thompson.
Here, the importance of, first of all, the conversation, but also of the work. For myself, after we lost Philando, I lost my mother. I lost my mother like right after, a few weeks after, and then like a few weeks after that, my son was shot 6 times at a funeral. And so I didn't see this 20-year-old kid. I just saw like the little baby I used to lay on my chest. But I would come out of that and like go back to work, and I just work extra hard. And people at work was like, "Well, you need to go and talk to somebody." And I was, "Man, I'm not crazy. I'm not going to see a psych. I'm not going to see a behavior. Nothing's wrong with me." But I did. I scheduled some time to see a behavioral health specialist. And one of the first things I said, because it was somebody who could resonate with what I was going through, was, "Man, I was crazy not to come and see you." That was one of the first things I said. So I admit myself, like, we walk around with this armor on, like we have no kind of, we're, especially men, we walk around like we just have no. And so I just want to say this is really important to me, and I want to thank you, because this conversation, like, it needed to be had. And what better place to have it than here with this body who can actually create the change we want to see. And I want to say thank you again to Representative Frank for your words and including everybody. Like, because this is just not a white thing. Everybody suffers from mental health. And we think we don't have problems, but we really do. We do need to see somebody. So I say thank you again, guys, for this conversation.
Thank you, Representative Thompson, for sharing your background and sharing what you've been through and how important what we have in front of us is today. And I want to thank the entire committee and our testifiers. These are tough issues, and it's important that we get these right. And we appreciate the focus that Representative Bang has brought forward for this bill, the people who are willing to come forward, share what they've seen, what's happening now, what's been happening historically, and where we need to go forward. And it also represents how this is everybody working together. This is not Democrat versus Republican. This is all of us coming together, because that's what it's going to take to continue to solve these problems. And I appreciate the dialogue that we've been able to have today, and I encourage that we continue this. I encourage that as our authors of the bills that have been working on them today, continue to reach out to Representative Frankie, Representative Baker, the folks on the Republican side who are just as passionate on these issues, to make sure that we're getting it right, so that we've got a system that works for everybody as we go forward. Seeing no other comments or discussion at this point in time, I renew my motion that House File 970, as amended, be recommended for referral to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Frankie.
Aye.
Frankie, aye. Backer. Baker.
Baker, aye.
Becker, Finn.
Aye.
Becker, Finn, aye. Hansen. Hansen. Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Katiza Watoon, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Pearson. Pearson.
Aye.
Pearson, aye. Thompson.
Thompson, aye.
Thompson, aye. Backer. Hansen. All right, there being 10 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
Okay, with 10 ayes and 0 nays, the motion has prevailed and House File 970 as amended is recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We have reached the end of our agenda today. I want to say thank you once again for everybody being involved. This is very hard work at times, very important work, but I appreciate everyone's commitment to continue to work on the issues as we go forward. We're going to have some more bills coming up to us over the coming weeks and look forward to continued input from all sides to make sure that we've got great bills going forward that will help improve the lives of Minnesotans who have been dealing with behavioral health issues. With that, I will mention that we will continue to take testimony on today's agenda items for the record for another 24 hours. And with that, we are adjourned.